So you're like CFO, accountant, HR, and front staff, front desk.
And let's not forget when equipment broke down, you know, I would be the guy. I was the repairman as well. So I think there was one day where he's going, hey, you know, my pool needs really, he goes, I'm going to be gone. There's certain things going on. People can't get to it. He wanted me to go out and spray, you know, basically hose down the pool and get it ready. So, you know, I've done a little bit of everything, you know.
The goal of this show is to help healthcare organizations scale by leveraging real estate strategies and interviewing high-level healthcare executives who are actively in the trenches in order to pull out lessons learned along the way. If you'd like a free site selection analysis from our team, or you'd like to learn more about how we're acquiring real estate through our fund on the blockchain, visit us at www.reuniversity.org and drop us a line. That's RE as in real estate, university.org. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Commercial Real Estate Secrets. I'm your host, Austin Hare, and I want to welcome our guest today, Jeff Staser. He's the CFO and Director of Strategic Planning at Strain Dental Management. They currently have 32 locations, and they're set to close on 10 more in 2 months. So we're talking very high, very rapid growth. And Jeff, thanks for coming on today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always nice to see people in the industry, and glad to chat today.
Yeah. So, you know, you've been in the industry for about 10 minutes now, it sounds like, and have a thing or two that you could share. No, I'm just kidding. Your history goes way back all the way to, you know, Heartland before it was Heartland, but, yeah. You know, really, I want to, even before that, I mean, what was it like for you growing up? Did you know that you wanted to be in business? I mean, did you have any entrepreneurial experiences? Like who were like some influences on you from an early stage?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I had a great, great family background. I mean, the moms, if you will, of you know, all my aunts and my mom were very instrumental in setting the tone for the family. The guys kind of took a, I don't say a back seat, but they understood that the women had it going on and that they were the ones driving, you know, the kids and keeping us where we needed to be in school.
Keeping you guys in line.
Exactly. So I had a grandmother that was just terrific. You know, somebody that showed you that you had to roll up your sleeves every day and go to work. So tremendous work ethic and, you know, not rich by any stretch of imagination. Didn't, you know, she always wanted everybody to go to college. That was a strong desire of hers. And that was very instrumental throughout our family. And so for me, you know, growing up, knowing I was going to go to college and what all that meant, you know, for me, I didn't have a clue in a small town of 1,000 people. What all I knew was, you know, you talk to your counselors at school and they'd be going, okay, what are you going to do with your life? And I'm thinking not very broad. I'm thinking a town of 1,000 people. There's only two positions I really, really want. I want to be I guess I could be president of the local bank or I could be superintendent of the schools. You know, that's kind of where my mindset was.
Yeah.
But went to school, probably caught the bug, thought I would go into science, but I really caught the bug for being an accountant. And, you know, at that particular point in time, I didn't have any desire, I think, to be a tax accountant, you know, per se. But I knew that would give me a great understanding of business and the roles that I wanted to be in. And obviously trying to own my own business at some particular point in time. That's where, you know, it ended up in college. So, you know, part of that childhood was growing up with my next door neighbor was Rick Workman. You know, you may have heard that name, founder of Heartland Dental. But him and Rick and I are first cousins. And so he was like a big brother to me all growing up, about 5-6 years older than me. He went to dental school. I thought science would be something I wanted to do. I thought maybe I'd follow in some of those, you know, footsteps of him because I always idolized him and looked up. But at the same token, you know, when the passion called for accounting and business school, that's kind of where I took it. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, you got out of college, you know, and I got my first job. And within 5 months, Rick goes, hey, you and I have always had a great relationship, a trusting relationship. He goes, I need help. You know, come work with me. He goes, you know, I don't have a whole lot to offer right now. I can pay you more than you're making now. And lo and behold, guess what? I got a house you can live in. So we became roommates. Okay. This is
age difference between you guys?
5 years. I think he was born in January of 55 and I'm June of 60.
Okay. So all right. Yeah. So growing up, you probably looked way up to him because that's like, you know, that's a huge difference when you're in middle school and high school. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And sports was very important. He was very successful in his own right with running and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, sports was, you know, I wanted to be like him and my uncle. I had an older uncle that, you know, ended up passing away from cancer when he was 29, but testicular cancer. But, you know, they were just idols to me, you know, and you always spent all your time with them, and they always took me under their wing and you know, showed me things that I probably shouldn't have known at my age, but, but it was a very good environment for me to be in. And so, you know, when I got out of business school and had that first job where I came to work, I was like, why not? Let's take a chance. Let's go do it. So for about 2.5 years, I helped him, and then ended up from, he had 3-4 locations, small communities, well, Austin.
Was that, I mean, let's just back up for 1 second. So you're in school, you just graduated. I mean, I remember like when I was in college and graduating, it's like, there's a lot of stress. Like you don't really know what you want to do. And some people get depressed. Yeah. I mean, some people just lose motivation. Like, I mean, what was that like to come out of school? And then this guy who you looked up to, I mean, you said he's like your big brother. He offered you a job. Right. Was that unexpected? I mean, that had kind of like a dream come true, right?
It was when I got, I mean, you know, I'll back up to, it was about April and I graduated in May and I'd had a job, you know, committed to through, you know, the interviewing processes on campus. And so I just remember coming home one day and going, I don't think I want this job. I was going to move from one small town to another small town. And, you know, one of the hardest things was to go to my dad and go, hey, guess what? I'm not moving out of the house quite now yet because I don't want to take this job. And so, you know, I didn't set on the unemployment line, but it took me a couple months to really find something in a small community, what I really, really wanted to do. And that didn't last very long. So for him to come to me in 5-6 months and go, hey, you know, here's an opportunity. I mean, it was really special. That's cool. It really was.
You know? That's cool. Okay. And, so now, yeah, you've got this cool opportunity from this guy that you looked up to, kind of probably feels like you're living the dream. And he invites you to live in his house with him. I mean, what's that like, living and working with somebody?
I think because we had such a great relationship and the family bonding that we'd had all those years, it was really kind of easy, believe it or not. It was one of those things that you felt comfortable, you know, asking questions. You felt comfortable challenging decisions, you know what I'm saying? And yet you knew that you were there helping him get to where he wanted to be, you know, short term. I had no visions that it was ever going to turn into Heartland at all. That was never a thought process. You know, it was, you've got 3 locations you need help with. While you're at one location, you need payroll done. You need the bills paid. You need the phone answered, basically, Austin. You know, somebody, you know, so I'm sitting in the other office and, hey, can I help you?
So you're doing, you're like CFO, accountant, HR, and front desk.
And let's not forget when equipment broke down, you know, the repairman. I was the repairman as well. So I think there was one day where he's going, hey, you know, my pool needs really, he goes, I, you know, I'm going to be gone. There's certain things going on. People can't get to it. He wanted me to go out and spray, you know, basically hose down the pool and get it ready. So, you know, I've done a little bit of everything. You know?
Yes. Add pool boy to the list too.
Exactly. All good times though. I mean, I can't imagine a better education in that regard because of the entrepreneurial spirit Rick had and the things that were brought to light for me.
Yeah. But reflecting back on that chapter, what do you think would be like your biggest mistake/learning experience? And then the thing that you guys did right to like the best decision that you made?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of that was, you know, for him was, you know, tax planning at the time. That was very, very important to him to make sure he was avoiding taxes. Investment tax credits were, you know, something doesn't exist today, but you could go out and do, you know, buy real estate and, you know, 10% investment credit. I mean, investment credit was a really big thing back in the, you know, in the 80s or mid 80s or whatever. And so that allowed for a lot of opportunity to expand and grow that doesn't exist today. So from that perspective, I think that tax avoidance, if you will, the right way I call it, was good. Probably one of the other aspects that probably wasn't as well thought out was being in smaller communities of 1,000 to say 2,500 and the realization of what were you actually going to be able to sell. I mean, if you think about it from a business perspective, it's one thing, it's like stock market. It's easy to buy a stock. The hard part's knowing when to sell. And so, you know, it's easy to get into business, but really, where are you going with it? What's the exit strategy at some point in time? Where does that take you? You know, where is the end game? And I don't think that was as well thought out. Maybe it was more about buying a job you know, investing.
So, like, are you, let me see if I'm understanding you right. Are you saying that it was a town of 1,000? How many dental offices could it support? Is that what you're saying?
No, you're, exactly. I mean, he was there one day a week. I mean, a small town of 1,000 people in it. And he was really going there one day a week. Okay. And he would say, well, I could hire an associate that can come and work a half a day here and a half a day. So he had himself and a couple associates that were, you know, going to these other locations, but nothing that you would say today would support, you know, nearly even close to 4 days a week, you know, and then being in a small town, how many people really, if you're getting ready to sell that, how many attract people could you attract to a town of 1,000 people? Yeah.
Right. So, okay.
So I think the thing you would think if you're going to invest, you'd look in a larger community today. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. So that was the biggest takeaway is more essentially patients or customers, right? It's like fishing in a place where there's more fish.
Exactly. You know? Absolutely.
Okay. All right. And so like what caused you to transition out of that? Like how long were you there? And then why did you transition out?
I was there about 2.5 years. Okay. And, you know, there wasn't beyond the first experiences of knowing how to be like a, you know, a banker slash accountant, you know, slash payroll clerk, you quickly ran through the gamut of opportunity, if you will, for me. And I felt I needed to expand and grow. And so the local bank there needed somebody in the trust department. And so I chose to interview and the one thing that the president of the bank told me at the time, he goes, I just love the energy that you bring to the table. He goes, you know, there's just, you know, you don't find people that really at the end of the day want to take the next step. They're looking for opportunity. And that was me. I was just, I was hungry for knowledge and I always have made it, you know, my grandma, I go back to my grandma and my aunts. It was always about life learning, you know, it's continue to learn. You're either growing or you're dying. So I went to the bank, got the job in the trust department. And at that particular point in time, the president of the bank, who was just a tremendous person to work for, said, hey, I want to be able to sell stocks and bonds and mutual funds and annuities and everything right out of the bank. And he said, I want you to go get your license. I want you to do that. And I want to set up, you know, call what you want. He said, I want to set up a brokerage division right inside the bank. And I said, you'll have to have some, you know, some things in place that people know it's not FDIC insured and all that. So it was really easy for me. My next step was to go get my Series 7 license, my insurance license. And I'm, you know, I've got people that have $100,000 CD in the bank, you know, FDIC insurance back then was anything above 100. You were, you know, it was still, there was risk, you know, in people's minds. So, you know, I got a lot of opportunity to sit down with a lot of people in the community of Effingham that had money. And, you know, we were the first bank to do it. And it was just a great situation for me to be in and grow, meet people, learn about the, you know, everything from you call it from all types of investments. I'll put it that way. And knowing from that, what I wanted in life more was, okay, the banking opportunity wasn't going to last long for me because I just saw the amount of wealth that people could create, how they got it. Things like that, the lessons. I mean, I would go to, you know, breakfast and buy a cup of coffee with, you know, with the business people of Effingham and sit down with them and say, help me understand how you did what you did. You know, just to learn, you know, again, that's one.
And these are people that you're also they're investing with you as well, or are these just relationships? Okay. So it's kind of like a two-way street. Yeah. Like you're trying to invest their money and help them get a return, but you're also building a relationship and you're trying to learn from them.
Correct. And so some of the other people, there was Beardstown Ladies. Have you ever heard of Beardstown Ladies Investment Club? Okay. This was an investment club that was started by the people of Beardstown, Illinois. They wrote a book.
Wait, I might have. But, okay. Keep telling the story.
Yes. Yeah. And so they met every so often, like once a month, and they would put money into their, you know, into the coffers of the club, and we'd invest in stocks and learn about them and so on and so forth. Anyway, we started that with a group of guys that were my age, you know, at the time, you know, I'm 25, 26 years old, and we were meeting once a month and just talking about what everybody knew and understood and what opportunities were and where business would take you and things like that. So gaining a great perspective on what it took, you know, to to be an entrepreneur. Oh, really?
So, and that was entrepreneur slash investor, or because those things are kind of different.
Yeah, as of the bank. Well, you know, think about the bank. Think about that mindset of being a banker, if you will, or working for a bank and being a broker. I mean, I was one of the first two or three in the state of Illinois to have a broker's license and working in the bank. Okay, in Illinois, Effingham, of all places, Effingham, Illinois. And so just you experienced, I mean, there was just a huge amount of information came my way in a very short period of time.
So that's probably huge advantage back then, because now everybody gets information everywhere. But back then, it sounds like one of the smartest things you did was just building relationships with people that you could share information with, because you have to essentially create your own internet, like your own inner working of things. I heard one of my favorite podcasts is called the All In Podcast. And the most recent one, they were talking about, can you beat the market, essentially? And so they made an interesting distinction. And what he was talking about was, prior to 2008, that the individual stock pickers essentially would rely, like that you could bet on the alpha and do well, meaning like, was there individual stocks that had a differentiator, like a difference maker from other stocks? And then, and you could beat the market, like, you know, you could make careers doing that. And people did, right? But then what happened in 2008 was you had a lot of central bank intervention, for better or for worse. You know, in my opinion, it's worse, but it is what it is. So there's a lot of, a lot of money printing, a lot of interest rate manipulation or lowering, if you will. And so now you've created beta, right? Meaning like the whole market benefits from this as a whole. And so his point was like, based on the central bank intervention since 2008, it's very, very difficult, almost impossible for stock pickers to outperform the market. Now, the ironic part is you kind of need the people to try and pick it out that like creates that equilibrium in the marketplace, but it's very difficult. And unless we go back to a stage where there's going to be less intervention, like central bank intervention, than there was before, it's just gonna be really hard for individual stock pickers to beat the market, because there's so much beta with liquidity and low interest, artificially low interest rates, and that sort of thing. So do you agree? And like, have you seen that? I mean, you said 86 or whatever. I mean, has that been true?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the hard part for me at age 26 was trying to decide what stocks to buy. You know, I'd said, I was almost paralyzed, because being an accountant and that analysis that you would learn to do and the study and you would learn to do, it almost paralyzed you to make, you know, decisions on what would be a good stock. Well, I mean, I remember I had a buddy came in and he sat down and talked to me. He goes, well, what do you think about Walmart? And this is in 19, this is 87 now. And the market took the dip in October of 87. And he's coming in, what do you think about Walmart? I'm like going, well, you know, if you're asking me, I just didn't have that perspective at the age of 26 to look out 20 years. I'm looking at it going, well, the market dives and, you know, people are concerned about this. I just can't see myself putting money in a Walmart. Wow, what a stupid decision, you know, but it didn't take me long to realize that, okay, I don't have the expertise. I'm not a money manager. So what I did was I started creating this diversification model where I would sit down and talk to somebody like yourself and go, tell me what your risk tolerances are. Tell me, you know, what are things you want to achieve, you know, 5 years from today, 10 years from today, what are you trying to create money for, if you will. And then I would profile them and set up mutual funds that were managed professionally. And then
based on their risk appetite, kind of.
Correct. And so maybe 80% would go into the stock market, with 40% of that 80% going into, you know, some S&P 500, things like that. So I was really into that type of stuff, you know, eventually at the bank and creating, you know, my own little mutual fund.
Did your time there, did that give you a philosophy around investing? Like, how would you summarize that in like a sentence or two?
I mean, if I was to summarize that, it's like, I want to invest across the spectrum. You know, I'd rather have index funds and things like that than I would individual stocks.
Yeah. Okay. So, that's just the skill like that you can apply to every single business. Cause I mean, timing markets can be extremely lucrative or extremely painful. So
take real estate, for example. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I look at that, I'm going, I've got X number of dollars that I can invest in one location. How about we, you know, the power of the investment club to me was, well, let's bring 10 people together with 100,000. Now let's buy 10 locations. And then, so then my risk was spread, you know, from one that might go bad. So that to me, diversification, not all your eggs in one basket. Those are very valuable lessons to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. I think for me, like the biggest learning thing has just been, it's timing or time in the market beats timing the market. It's like,
correct. Perfect.
You know,
perfect.
All these these short-term fluctuations. It's like, I think everybody's good at deciding when to sell. Right. But it's really hard to decide when to buy back in. Like when COVID, like around March and April, or sorry, right. February and March, everybody's saying sell. Okay, great. But who would have been able to buy back in on March 21st, 2020? I mean, that was the day, the most gloom, that was the day everything actually shut down and everything looked terrible. And that was the bottom of the market. Right. So
go back to October of 1987, when the market took the dip in October, I'm going to say it might have been around the 20th or so. I can't remember the exact date. When that market fell like it did, everybody thought, well, they'd never seen anything like this.
They thought the stock market was over.
Oh, yeah. You're thinking 1929 again. And so I had people walk in and go wanting to sell, but I had one guy that was about my age walk back in. He says, I'm going to buy him back in tomorrow. I want in. And he took, you know, $3,000. He was a wife and two kids. And he's like, this is all I got. I got $3,000. And he just pushed her. He's kind of like that whole Texas Hold'em.
Yeah.
I'm all in. All in. And it was back up within a week. And he was like, best decision I ever made.
So how did he double his money? I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool. I mean, to see him go and put everything at risk, but he picked out a couple stocks that he'd been following. He says, I'm all in. They bumped up, doubles his money. He's back out within a week. It was, you know, so.
Wow. I wonder how he's doing now. Do you have any idea if he's successful?
No, I really lost track with him. He still lives in Effingham, but we very rarely.
The lesson is, you know, be greedy when others are fearful, right? Like, I mean, right now is a good time too. Everybody was trying to say we're going down. I mean, right now we're recording this July 27th, 2022. And like, we just got out of a really rough bear market. Some people might say we're still in there, but a lot of people try timing or saying like, it's going to get worse. And it's like, if you would have just bought in like daily cost averaged in, I mean, you would have done really well, you know, now you'd have a lot lower cost basis.
I mean, you think about where we came with COVID and all that, and, you know, and the markets where they're at, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, the politics has been played here on and off for the last few years. There were people who decided, hey, when COVID hit, I got to get out of the market, stay out of the market. And I'm just not a believer in that. I think that's very efficient. You know, what you learn in school is that there's efficiencies in the market. And if you can stay the term, you're going to get rewarded for that. You know, you will.
Absolutely. So how long were you at the bank for? Because at some point you went back to working with Workman.
I was there, like, say, from 1986 to 1992.
Okay. Nice little run.
You know, yeah, it was. I mean, it was a good run. But I everything from stocks and bonds to learning how to do estate planning, because I was in what they call the trust division. Interesting name, but it was basically wills and estates and trust themselves and knowing that. So sitting there and seeing then Manny Moe and Jack and that prospectus and Sonic Drive-In, that prospectus come across the table. I'm going, you know, again, I was ready for another change. I think I'd learned a lot, and, you know, I knew Rick was
wanting. When you say the prospectus came across the table, like, this was at the beginning of those entities, like, they weren't national yet. These were just a couple of local guys.
They were. Manny Moe and Jack was already there. They were just trying to redo some some lending practices. Okay. You know, they were just going back to banks and asking for, you know, to restructure some of their debt. Sonic was trying to raise money to go into expansion mode to do the drive up, you know, type of, you know.
So were these their franchise model, right? Like, were these franchisees that were coming in?
Correct. Okay. Yep. Gotcha. Yep. Sonic Drive-Ins. Yep. Absolutely. And so I was going, if these people can raise money in that, we can raise money.
Right.
We can. And it's not, and it wasn't lost on Rick either. Don't get me wrong. I mean, and at that point in time with managed care, where it was at, we took a lot of he was taking some capitation programs, and we were allowed to, you know, really expand our patient base, if you will. And that's the other, you know, one of those things I learned as I came back was, you know, sell to the masses, live with the classes. Okay. You get into that environment, you know, of we had patient base. Okay. So we're accelerating our growth and doing things, and we're expanding because cash flow is good. And the pay, you know, we didn't have to really go out and do a whole lot of marketing because we had this capitation model helping roll forward. State of Illinois got, they had what they call quality care and managed care. They had two insurance companies. And so eventually we were able to get out of the capitation and raise our fees by going into the quality care, but we already had captured all these patients in our practice. So it just, you know, some of the business models that were created there were like, hey, we're as full as we can be. So now let's start moving from capitation to the quality care, if they call it. And we were able to retain a large percentage of that patient base just because of the way you treated patients. So now you got a higher paying patient, if you will. And it was just, it allowed our market expansion was terrific at that point in time. And then along came Compdent, and they saw us getting out of the capitation plan. So they said, we're just going to buy you. You know, you guys have done a great job what you're doing. We'll pay you more money than anybody else would. So back in those days, they ended up writing a check for 1.57 times revenue. And at that particular point was the largest deal we knew of.
Even today, 1.5 times is pretty good. Like, not many people are doing that.
Right. So that was like an eye-opening experience. And again, multiples probably back then, Austin, were probably 6 or 7, you know. And if you've got, you know, 15 million EBITDA today, you're probably talking, you know, you're going to clear north of 12 to 14. You know what I'm saying? So all those things, you know, like I say, the stars aligned. We sold to Compdent. Dr. Workman had about $8 million in his pocket, you know, roughly before taxes. I'll say before taxes.
Yeah.
And he's like, so I walk in and I was concerned about my job and my career. And, you know, is he going to retire? You know, is $8 million enough? He said, $8 million is not enough. He said, I think that we need to reemploy this and reinvest it and let's go to work. So
that's funny, you know, too. It's like the type of personality that can actually attain early retirement on the beach with a drink in their hand is the same exact type of personality that would never be happy doing that.
Exactly. You're exactly right. So then we fast forward and he's ready to start buying. And first couple were a disaster, you know, quite honestly, you know, buying. I mean, you know, it was just like, you know, he thought it was a dentist to dentist discussion, and we'd buy him and the dentist would up and leave or whatever. And so I went with him a couple times, and, you know, from there we started structuring how we were going to talk to the doctors about things and what we wanted and how we were going to put some things in place, to keep doctors around. So we started gaining some traction, but we were buying things and not when Rick and I were focused on the mergers and acquisitions. You know, we had a team, you know, a really good team that needed some direction. They were great managers. And so we brought in Kerry Strain. That's how I got to know Kerry Strain and met him. Yes, met him in 1999 out in Scottsdale. And he started talking about, you know, what he thought, you know, dental practice, the two or three things that they could
do. Yeah, for everybody listening, we had Kerry Strain on the podcast maybe about 4 episodes ago. So if anybody wants to go check that out, you can hear his story as well.
Right. Terrific mind, you know, probably one of the best minds in dentistry, quite honestly, as far as, you know, how to elevate a practice and get the systems in place to make that happen. And so 1999, we hired him, gave him 13 out of 33 locations that we had to do consulting for him. He was like, well, that was 13 practices. And for us, we're like, oh, we only had to give him a third of what we had, you know, we're getting all this knowledge for, you know, all the other two thirds. So it was a great marriage, if you will, great relationship. He brought a lot to the table. I, you know, refer to it as scaffolding, if you will, put the support structures in place to allow it to grow, foundation, you know, whatever concept you want to build. It was a concrete system that we knew that all we had to do was go and execute on. And we're pretty good executors. That's what I found. You know, we can execute. And so Heartland was off to the races. And in between 2003 and 2005, put 99 locations on the board. Yeah. and really that was through two people, really guy that, you know, to me, I'll always have the utmost respect for, John Collier, who still works at Heartland today, and myself. And we were just driving this process, you know, to get things going. Now, and you have to understand, once we'd find a location, I mean, these were probably half of them were de novos, Austin. So we had to build out the suites.
Is that because you just couldn't find enough to acquire to meet your growth goals? You had to grow de novo?
Probably being a little more selfish than that. I just didn't want to pay the prices some of the time to get those practices and know that you were going to have to new equipment. You know, I didn't want to be at that particular point in time. My mindset was, you know, give me a Blockbuster video and the best grocery store in town, and I want to be right between them. That was the marketing plan, you know.
Well, it's not a bad marketing plan. I mean, yeah, to talk on real estate for a second, you know, that like their locations are so important. So, just like it would make sense if you're looking at practices and they don't have good locations. I mean, they're essentially tapped out, right? I mean, the real estate can be such a big bottleneck if you don't have a good spot, high visibility, high foot traffic.
Right. Yep. I was always looking, you know, it seemed like the market was adjusting. You'd find doctors, dentists that had maybe a 4-chair practice that was on second and third, you know, I call it Second Street and Third Avenue. And we really at the time preferred to be on Main and First Street, Main Street, First Avenue,
where we Main and Main.
And so Main to Main. So I, you know, and John Collier, I think, coined the phrase fresh. He was like, I just want to be in the fresh part of town, you know? And so that was Blockbuster, the new grocery store, try to find a spot in between or close to. And it worked out really, really well. You know, whether it be an old Pizza Hut or an old Long John Silver's, that didn't bother us to go in and renovate and put a stamp on it. You know, said Heartland.
Were you like, how did you get the idea to go into a prominent retail location? Because like you said, a lot of like traditionally dentists were occupying medical offices, you know, condos that were 2 or 3 streets back from the main road. You know, trying to get as cheap as rent possible. At the time it was kind of like a novel idea. Like, was there other competitors doing that as well? Or did you guys follow like somebody else's blueprint or what?
Well, I think Kerry is one of those guys that told you that dentistry's got to be a little bit more like retail than medical at the time. You know, you got to think retail and that you got to be in top of the mind awareness. You got to be in front of them. This isn't trying to go out and build a hospital. It's, you know, you're talking what I was looking for at the time. We were looking to 5 to 6 chairs. I mean, we had it down to 2,700 square feet, 6 chairs, you know, in 6 treatment rooms. And so we were just looking for 27 by 72. You give me 27 by 72, I can design that office just like that. And so you start learning these little things as you went through it every time you did it. And, you know, we had a team that would go in and set it, you know, set the offices up. So John and I could just worry about building things out, making sure we were next location. And somebody came in behind us, Debbie Steppy, is a name at Heartland that, you know, she retired from just here recently in the last year or two, that would go in and then she'd be on the road right behind us setting all the offices up. You know, when it was ready to go, she'd go in for a week with her team. And next thing you know, the next week, so we can go from the building permit to day one of seeing patients, 6 weeks. So you 6 times 7. So it was 42, call 43 days. 43 days is day one. So 0 to 43, and we were in. And so
That's huge.
Yeah.
What about like in terms of buying versus leasing? Did you guys have a preference? Because if you're trying to go in between Blockbuster and, you know, any grocery store, I mean, none of that stuff is for sale.
You're
going to
be
leasing.
You're correct. So we didn't.
And if it was for sale, like that's still the trade-off there is it ties up your capital and it ties up your balance sheet, right? So banks are less likely to lend from you and then you don't have money for acquisition. So, I mean, there's a huge trade-off. So, is that the reasons that you guys, did you ever buy the real estate at all? Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, to your point, when we first, you know, when we got started, when we were rolling, it became very apparent that, you know, to be in some of these better locations, you were going to have to buy a bigger lot, you know, than 27 by 72, you know? So, you know, with Dr. Work myself, I sat down with him and said, look, you know, there's an opportunity here for us to own the real estate and turn this not, you know, cause you think about McDonald's is, you know, if you're a franchise owner today, you make money, but you know, the corporate, if you will, it's a real estate company. I mean, that's they're buying the real estate, to your point. They're buying and put places in. So for us, you know, I just said, I want to go into this marketplace and take the best opportunity I can. And what ended up happening is we would buy the locations, you know, if we could. And, you know, so the outlots that we were buying sometimes required us to put 10,000 square foot buildings in place versus, say, 2,500 square foot dental practice. Okay. And so what we would do at that particular point in time then is we'd go in with the idea and mindset, 10,000 square feet, put two dental offices side by side, and then we would find the other two tenants that we needed, whether it be a Starbucks or the wireless.
Like when you say two dental offices side by side, you would just do one that was twice as big as your regular one?
Two 6-chair facilities side by side. Okay. And then we'd figure out how to fill them up. And at that particular point in time, like in the state of Illinois, for sure, nobody would take Medicaid public aid. And so they raised those rates. And we already had that knowledge of how to do it with capitation. And we're like going, this is not going to be a long lasting thing, but let's fill everything up. One thing that Carrie was always stressful of is seats in the seats went out every time. The most expensive thing in a dental office is an empty chair.
Hmm. Yeah.
So we'd go out and build these 10,000 square foot buildings, and then we'd be on to the next, you know, as my colleague would say, fresh area. Where are we going next? So.
Yeah. And so, cause it kind of seems like the way I have observed owning versus leasing in real estate, number one, I mean, you always want the best location, right? So like if nothing is available to lease, then absolutely go out and buy it. But the trade-off is it can slow down your growth a lot. It's like, and really I think that I define slowing down your growth as plus, you know, two locations, right? Like if you're trying to do more than two locations a year, it's going to be very hard to own that real estate and grow at the same time, unless you just have like a really good partner, you know, like of a different entity. And so, but you get to a point where all of a sudden you can do both. Right. And like, I don't know exactly where that point is because it really depends on your financials, but it seems to be somewhere between 80 and 100 locations. Now you've got this thing rocking and rolling. You've got good credit. You know, the bank's willing to lend to you despite having like a lot of debt on the balance sheet. Right.
Yep.
It's like you've proven yourself. And then you can go ahead and do both. So it sounds like you guys just might have also been at that stage where it's like you're big enough, you're doing enough deals, you've proven your track record to where you can go out and get.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and study the real estate markets and things like that, back in my day when we first started that, you could, I called it the Carlton Sheets method of real estate. You could literally go out, find the real estate, go find an appraiser who would appraise it for more than what you were getting ready to buy it for. And then basically collect, you could take actually cash off the table at closing because.
So they weren't, cross checking the closing, I guess. Yeah. That changed 2006,
yes,
right?
That changed big time. So as I'm starting to go through this and, you know, real estate thing, I was buying real estate, no money down, getting money out of it. I mean, if you look at Heartland,
do you still own a lot of those buildings or did you sell them?
When I left Heartland in 05, you know, I just felt, you know, there was a time that, you know, I should have kept them. There's no doubt that would have probably been the smarter play, but because of all the things in effect going through a divorce and all that, I decided to liquidate, you know, and so.
Did you get fair market value at least at the time?
Yeah. I mean,
it still would have done really well.
I did. And I, like I said, when I left in 05, I was able to walk away. And if I didn't want to work, I didn't have to. But like to your point, you know, I just couldn't see myself sitting on the beach having a few drinks. And, you know, because it was like, so, you know, I helped, you know, I landed with, after leaving Heartland, I landed up with AJ Acerno and helped him a little bit. He was a former Heartland doctor and him and I had a great relationship. He said, come help me. I sat on his board for a while. I think when I started helping AJ a little bit on defining, you know, his structure, if you will, similar to Heartland. He was at 2 and he was at 27 when I was on the board, kind of stepped off the board with him. And, you know, Carrie was coming calling and I'd been coaching basketball, quite honestly, Austin. I mean, I was coaching, you know.
quite the diversion.
Oh, yeah.
From
our, oh, yeah. Like, I mean, you know, there's nothing greater, you know, experience in my life probably. Is to taking the young kids and seeing them grow from day to day in practice. And it wasn't really anything other than putting together a price process and a structure and having them come in and saying, this is not much different than life. You know, you got to get up and go to work every day, and you got to start being creative, and you got to find ways and what is it you really want to accomplish? And so, I mean, I ate it up for about, you know, very time consuming, wasn't making any money to say, you know, I guess $5,000-$6,000 a year to coach high school basketball. But, kids really bought into what we were selling and had a really good streak there for about 8 to 10 years. And so I was, you know, hated to walk away, but Carrie came calling and said, look, this is an opportunity. I want you to come back to dentistry. And I knew what happened at Heartland. So it wasn't like it couldn't be repeated. And so we've been working on the model. He's, you know, one of the brilliant minds in dentistry, in my opinion. I've always had a great respect for him and admiration. And then to be able to be him to call me and say, I want you to come and help me because you've done it before. Was just, you know, it's going to be nice for me. The driving force is I got a feather in my cap that says Heartland. I got a feather in my cap to help AJ Acerno. And now I'm going to have a feather in my cap when it comes to Carrie Strain, I think. And so, you know, we're off to the races with going to soon to be 40 locations. Real estate's got to be in that picture as well, Austin, somewhere. So same way, you know.
Yeah. So let's talk about what you're doing now at Strain Dental Management. Because you've had a long history. I mean, you know, essentially it was like it was 84 was when you kind of first started in the dental space?
Yep. Well,
so how are you combining everything that you've learned into this?
I'm very fortunate.
It's a loaded question. Well, I know.
you can be places in spite of or because of, you know what I'm saying? And I'm here because of all my experiences, you know, and I've had people tell me, you know, in life, you're made up of three things: the books you read, the people you meet, and the experiences you had. You know what I'm saying? And I've been pretty blessed to the people that have been in my life, like say from my grandmother on up, you know, to be able to see Rick Workman and his entrepreneurial spirit be, you know, and be side by side and see Heartland grow has been special. Carrie Strain, you know, I go back to my banking days with the bank president I had. Things have just fallen really well for me in those regards. And so those experiences have all built to say, I know what I'd like to do now. And for Carrie, that was saying, look, consulting has really done him well and served him well in what he's done. And he's passionate about what he does. He's like, these doctors who now have $2 and $3 million practices, they can't unleash the equity anywhere. You know, there's limited buyers. So in order to get there, you got to form that DSO in order to create the highest and best value if you're going to sell. And people that are out there in the business today, you know, my experience as Heartland was that, you know, I owned about 3 to 5% of the business. Okay. Rick owned 91-92% of it. And so when I was going out doing these acquisitions, I knew the value that was getting created. I knew the multiple. It was worth 4 times. When we bought it, it was worth 4 times. And I'm sitting at the dinner table and the guy's guy, you know, you'd have guys or ladies go, oh, I can't go with your offer of 70%. I've got to have 72% of revenue because that's how things were sold back then. And I'm like, okay, I'll give you 72, you know, and I'll buy dinner. And so, you know, coming home, you know, and so you just knew you were creating this wealth, and it was really going to primary.
There's that, playing in the arbitrage, really.
Exactly.
Buying on the, on the collections and selling on the EBITDA.
Right. Kind of thing. Exactly. And I knew I was creating wealth for really Rick Workman, a lot of wealth, you know what I'm saying? And I got rewarded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got nothing to complain about. So it was worked out. But I think when Carrie sat down with me and said, look, I've helped these guys establish things they can't sell. I'd like to create this DSO and I want the doctors to own 80%. I think I'm in a special place now. I think I'm in the right spot where I was meant to be with growing up. Cause I love putting deals together and sitting down and figuring out that equation to make sure that it works for the doctors as well. And the doctors are going to own more than 80% when it's all said and done of this group. And, you know, as we acquire and buy, but right now, we're doctor led, doctor focused. And I always look at it as a timeline. Austin, I just said, you know, there's a timeline to this DSO and, you know, it'll outlast me. It'll outlast you. I think it'll outlast Carrie Strain as far as the company called Strain Dental Management. But I want to know when you want to get off the bus, Austin. I want to know as a doctor, when do you want to exit? And my job is nothing more than to enhance your economic values, showing you how it can be handled, and allowing you to exit when you want to exit with very little risk. I mean, a general practitioner today, if you think about it, you know, 50 years old, I mean, if he gets hit by a car tomorrow, well, where's this one of his biggest assets? Where's it go? You know, the opportunity to roll into a company and gain the lion's share of your equity back and know that it's going to play out by bringing investors. And that's all it is. It's like real estate. You know as well as I do, with the real estate market, the dental market, it's just collectively, we're just a conduit to get people to that want to invest their retirement money in something a little bit more stable than the stock market. That's all we're doing. You know what I'm saying? We're just finding a conduit for people to invest, whether it be the real estate market, the DSO market, whatever that may be, or the stock market. And I feel like that's kind of where my life experiences has taken me, from helping people plan out their retirement and helping them with stocks and bonds, to now I'm trying to help them plan them and be a part of a mutual fund of dental practices. So,
yeah. So on that note, like, what level of autonomy do like the doctors get, and like what level of autonomy do they want? And then how do you kind of combine that under one roof? Cause that's kind of like, that's why it's such a profitable, you know, lucrative thing to be in mergers and acquisitions in the healthcare space when it's done right.
Right.
Because that part of the equation just seems like a lot of people underestimate it.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you guys approach that?
Well, let's go back to that paralysis by analysis. When I was talking about being a stock market guy, you know, you get somebody who now is a dentist. If all they have to do is come in and be a dentist, you know what I'm saying? And they don't have to worry about mowing their yard. They don't have to worry about, you know, you name it, whatever aspect of their dental practice. If all they need to do is be the leader and take care of people clinically, you know, and give the highest value they can, they're much better at doing dentistry than I am. Trust me. So, but I think that I can bring to the table some of, I can take off their plate. All right, if they're spending 4 hours a week or 5 hours a week in management, I can take a lot of those issues off their table, you know, off their plate, and put that 4 or 5 hours into dentistry. They make more money, and we've got a much more successful product in the long run, you know. And the other thing about being larger is that we're providing opportunities to people that are dental assistants and hygienists and business assistants, that they've got an opportunity for growth. They've got an opportunity to create more wealth, because we're going to, you know, if they stay, they're going to get part of the, you know, part of the ownership of the business, which they can't have before. You don't get that outside the DSO. The dental office is only dental to dental is all you can sell. If we can structure this right, take things off their plate and allow them to do what they do best, we all win. You know what I'm saying? We all win. I'm not a very good sewer, so you don't want me trying to put together the prom dress for your daughter, because I can't do it, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Do you consider yourselves consolidators or operators?
Operators, distinctive operators, 110% of the time. Okay. I mean, I think that there are, the conduit out there for consolidators is there. We know that happens, but the only thing we're interested in is creating a legacy that says, you know, the doctors win. All right. I mean, if you go back to my upbringing, small family farm, I call it very small. Okay. So one of those that, you know, probably tried to outlive its life and should have died long before. Okay. But, you know, you got to, the thing you did learn from being a farmer is you can only, you know, you're going to plant in the spring and you're going to, you know, harvest in the fall. And you can't avoid those two things. You got to be there when those things happen, you know, and you're praying for rain, you know what I'm saying? So, I feel we're just in the environment of being operators. Okay. That's where we need to be. Carrie is like I say, one of brilliant minds in that regard. So distinctive operators all the way, not consolidators.
Yeah, that's cool. So as we're kind of getting close to our time, what is there anything that you want to talk about that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
I mean, I can't imagine what it is. You know, I appreciate you being on, and sometimes it's hard for, you know, you to talk about yourself and all that stuff. So hopefully I haven't bored everybody out there. But, you know, I think that the dental marketplace and seeing it evolve over the years, I'm happy with where it is today. I think that it's, you know, I think for other dentists to realize and understand, it's just, like I say, it's a conduit. Okay. And if they'll sit down and talk with me, just like they would sit down and talk to you with real estate, I think that we've got a better game plan for them, you know, for the long term. And for me to have them understand that I don't do clinical, I don't want to do clinical. That's not what I do. All right. You be you, I'll be me. You know, as they say, you do you, boo boo. But I think that the market's got a long place to go. I mean, I think that there's a lot of opportunity here for us to help people. And I do feel it's important. I think medical went this way a long time ago. You don't see the guy who has the single, you know, one story building with a shack outside says, hey, I'm a general, you know, I'm a general practitioner. The Marcus Welby's of the world don't exist anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of activity that's going to be happening over the next 3 to 5 years. Yep. And now's the time to act. So
Absolutely.
So, all right. And then any podcast recommendations or just favorite podcasts or any book recommendations, any favorite books, you know, self-development or business related?
Yeah. I mean, when I first started, the E-Myth was definitely important to me, and Think and Grow Rich. Those are two books. I mean, I like Think and
Grow Rich. I love those books.
Yeah. Okay. Think and Grow Rich was really easy. It's a real easy read. I told one of my one of the guys I golf with, his son, he's an accountant. He goes, hey, where do I start? I said, read two books, do the E-Myth and the E-Myth Revisited. So one book.
Okay.
And then Think and Grow Rich, read that one. I had my daughters read it at the age of 12. So it's an easy read.
Well, great. Okay. And if anybody wants to learn more about what you guys are doing and reach out, what's a good resource for that?
You can probably find us on the website at Strain, but you know, jeff@strain.com, and that Strain is spelled with an E, STRAINE.com. Just reach out to me. I've got a cell, 217-821-5100. If you want to call me direct, say, hey, you know, we'll chat. Love to help people, see what we can do. You know, we're only going to grow if we think in terms of a mastermind and we share ideas.
Yeah, I agree. Well, cool. I got those down in the show notes, and this has been great. I loved hearing your story. I think a lot of people really enjoy, you know, hearing the inside story of kind of how it all went down, because, you know, it's such a well-known DSO that you were a part of. So, and then I'm really excited to see what you guys are doing at Strain Dental Management as well.
I am too. I'm glad I'm back in the business. I love what I do every day, and it's going to be a nice journey here. It really
is. Man. Well, thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
If you need help finding the perfect location for your practice, or you're ready to invest in commercial real estate, email us podcast@leadersre.com. That's podcast@leadersre, R-E as in real estate.com.